This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. So it is a Fed Wednesday, and we know the Fed, of course, kept rates unchanged. They are continuing their asset purchase of $120 billion per month. But again, as expected, bringing forward that dot plot, and we've definitely seen reaction, as Charlie just mentioned, in the financial markets. Let's talk about it, though, with Doug Cioka, who has seen a lot of Fed meetings and a lot of cycles. Doug Cioka is CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners, and they've got roughly $970 million in assets under management. He's with us once again from Leawood, Kansas. Hey, Doug, nice to have you back with us on this Fed Wednesday. How do you read this report?
Yeah, thank you for having me back. I mean, I don't know that a lot of the language was, or the press conference answers were all that surprising, Carol. I mean, I think the Fed still has near unanimity, right, on the prospects of patience. And they've been given cover lately when you get a kind of a weaker retail sales print yesterday, and we've not had that huge non-farm payroll print that seemingly everyone has anticipated. So, you know, I think it was logical to see some of the dots rise of the beloved dot plot, given some of the hot inflation points since the last meeting. But the increase in rates is about inflation, yes. Growth, yes. Right? I think there's collectively elevated increase of GDP projection by 0.5% this year. But, you know, the unemployment forecasts haven't really changed. And I generally don't think the dots are as meaningful as policy. They're not policy, nor are they an average of a projection of policy. So I didn't find a lot from the meeting to be all that substantive or surprising.
Well, and I feel like going through and parsing through all the headlines, I mean, it definitely did feel like a little bit of a jolt, especially to, you know, hear some talk and conversations about, you know, interest rates maybe sooner rather than later. But we knew ultimately they were going to raise. He also talked about the Fed chief about being accommodative still for a long time. And he is going to watch that employment rate and is willing to let inflation go a little hot to get to that point where we get back to getting Americans back to work.
Yeah, I think he underscored very well and thoroughly that the recovery is, as he called it, incomplete. Right, unemployment is still 5.8%. Mm-hmm. So why we would be in a rush to tighten, I'm not sure. But you also have to understand the context of the recovery and the extrication of stimulus. The Fed is only one half of the story. And the Treasury / Congress is equally as important, particularly as it relates to the inflationary influences being anything but transitory, if that makes sense.
Well, what does that mean then as investors? So how, or you're right, it's not just the Fed that has, you know, pumped a lot into this economy to get it to where it is at this point. So as investors, yeah. What, I don't know, how do we read that?
Yes, so I think it's just, so you think about it as the Fed and Treasury, which helped us get through the depths of the pandemic, economically and from the standpoint of the markets, mm-hmm. They were very coordinated in their policy posture. And they must stay coordinated in their stances. They remove some of the stimulus, right? Disharmony in the part of the Fed and the Treasury will be far more devastating to markets than a taper, right? Because the taper, if you think about it, would be the result of effective fiscal policy. The Fed would only taper if it felt the economy could handle it. The economy can handle it in large part from the stimulus, which bridged the production gap as the world went through COVID. Mm-hmm. So better to take accommodation out of a robust economy where volume is playing well with margin, and when the strength, then when to do that when it is strong, then when the strength begins to dissipate. And yes, I mean, inflation is a byproduct of that strength, but it can still be beneficial at this point of the cycle if it is indeed transitory. And I think this is important.
Well, go ahead, because that's where I was going to take you. I mean, it's safe to say at this point, Doug, that we are still dealing with data points that have been impacted by the pandemic, and we're still bouncing back from those significant lows. Until we kind of get purer data, we don't really have a true assessment of the economy.
I would agree. And I would think one of the things that it's surprised investors is the continued strength of the stock market coming out of such a strong fourth quarter of last year and first quarter of this year was because we hadn't even fully priced in the massive amount of earnings growth that was the function of the economy reopening. Right, and the Fed is taking most of the criticism, but it really needs to be shared going back equally on the fiscal policymakers, because the inflation that's a byproduct of the strength can be beneficial if companies still have the ability to pass along higher input costs, if it invites competition that benefits the end buyer. And consider that inflation is actually a contribution to total market returns over history anyway.
Right.
But when inflation becomes problematic, Carol, if it turns out not to be transitory, because fiscal policy overstays its welcome once monetary policy begins to leave the party.
But again, we don't know.
Cross purposes, that's going to create confusion.
It's like Uber, right? Like when you need a car and all of a sudden it starts to rain and the prices get really expensive. And then all of a sudden more cars, I mean, this is how the model's supposed to work, more cars come on and then the price goes down. I mean, if indeed we see some of these supply chain bottlenecks or these, you know, price increases for commodities and so on and so forth, we've seen copper, lumber already start to come down. We know Powell talked about that a little bit, I think lumber specifically. But I mean, until we know, again, as you said, transitory or not,
right,
it's hard to know what the true picture is of inflation.
Oh, I think that's right. But I think one of the ways that you do it is in the absence of an exactitude in the ongoing science experiment is you have to do it piecemeal, and you have to do it within a laboratory that is still conducive to the underlying economic growth. And we've been harping on this point for a while, but the retention of a high velocity of money is so important as we realign fiscal and monetary policy so we can reset an appropriate base case. And it's the velocity of money that catalyzes economic growth, which offers cover for this subtle pivoting, as long as the implementation of the extraction is not combined with what we call unnatural impediments. Right? So what's an unnatural impediment? Higher capital gains taxes at the inception of a very delicate point of the recovery. Legislation that's done by reconciliation as opposed to actual compromise and constructive collaboration. Trade policy malignment. Those are the kind of things that will convolute the outcome of the experiment and muddle the base case, which just means it'll be more guessing into the future and probably instigate more volatility.
All right, so what do we do as an investor? Bottom line.
Bottom line is if you consider where we are, both equity and fixed income, right, one of the broader implications and challenges that faced anyone that is investing money right now is this whole traditional and classic 60-40 model under assault.
Obvious
challenges in fixed income markets producing anywhere near the returns they did in the last 15 years for the next 15 years. Right? Just a zero mathematical bound alone keeps a responsible lid on expectations. So you have to look outside of conventional fixed income right now. What's that? Floating rates, private credit, convertibles, emerging market debt, things that have better risk-adjusted potential with positive real yields. And then within equity, we think four things, right? Active management in equity both domestically, and then the second thing, branching out to more foreign countries that have not yet participated to the extent of the economic recovery that we have here. And I think you have to be in specific companies that are economically not interest rate sensitive, those that have pricing power and broad competitive advantages. And finally, weave in subtle inflation hedges, right? Companies and countries that benefit from a weaker U.S. dollar, emerging markets, financial services companies on foreign and domestic shores. And then I said floating rate debt and EM and frontier market debt, but also multinational companies, because get the benefit of currency conversions in a weak dollar environment with a large and continuing to grow global economy.
Hey, listen, do you think, like some others, that we are going to see some kind of, at least on the equity side of things, a market correction in the second half of the year just because we've gotten ahead of ourselves?
Highly possible. I mean, now what we've had, 4.5% drawdown for the year to date in almost 6 months, and typically we would expect about a 13 or 14%, average annual drawdown. So I think it'd be highly possible that we do. And, if we do, I think that could be very beneficial, right? It almost seems blasphemous or treasonous to want the stock market to correct. But
I like it when some of the fluff is taken out, to be quite honest.
Absolutely. We agree. Valuations in check are important.
All right, Doug. Good to get you, especially on this Fed day, and get your insight. Doug Scioca, he's CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners. They've got roughly $970 million in assets under management. Doug joining us on the phone from Leawood, Kansas.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
So one of the many reasons we love Business Week, it takes us to places, new ideas. This time around, it's a $110 million helmet that aims to mine health secrets from the mind. Let's get into it. Someone who always takes us also to cool new places, ideas, and innovations. Bloomberg Businessweek feature writer and New York Times bestselling author Ashley Vance, host of Hello World, author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the quest for a fantastic future. He's with us from Palo Alto, and also with us is Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber on the Access line in Brooklyn. These are the kind of stories I just learned more and more about, not only the subjects that Ashley writes about, but about Ashley.
Yeah, Boy, the subject of this one's going to be a fun one to talk about. So Ashley, who are we talking about, and what does this brain scanning helmet that he's developed do?
Yeah, well, there's a guy named Brian Johnson who's kind of the main character of the story. He's not super well known, but he is very rich. He sold a company called Braintree to PayPal for several hundred million dollars a few years ago. And then he took all that money and started this new company called Kernel, which is, like you said, they've built these helmets that can peer through your skull, see all the electrical activity, see all the blood flow, and basically watch your neurons fire in real time. And you know, the big breakthrough really is we have machines that do some of the stuff like fMRI machines and MEGs, things that you would find at a hospital or a research center. And, you know, he's found a way to boil all this down into a helmet that anybody could wear.
So I'm going to put this on, and what's it going to do for me exactly?
You know, I mean, there's a few things going on. His kind of driving thesis is this idea that for mental health, if you went to the doctor and you were worried about your heart, they would run all these tests on you, you know, obviously do some blood work. And we just don't have anything like that for the brain. And so he wants, you know, partly because these things have been expensive and hard to use, we just don't have much data on the brain. And so he wants to make these affordable enough that thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even millions of people would be using these machines to see their brain activity as they go through their day, as they try to recover from an illness like a stroke or Parkinson's disease, and that we would just learn a lot more about how the mind works.
Well, and that's the point, Ashley, right? I mean, we do know a lot about the body. We do know a fair amount about the brain, but there is so much that is unknown. And he thinks about it kind of juxtaposed against artificial intelligence, too.
Yeah, you know, he started this company. I've been following him for a few years, and he really started when he thought that AI was getting so powerful that humans would not stand a chance against it, and that our only hope was to kind of, you know, merge with machines and create this brain machine interface. It's a way that really you could add computing horsepower to your own brain and vice versa. So that's kind of the root of all this. Over time, Brian, he's an interesting character. He's really into kind of the quantified self movement. He has all these tests done on his body, and he's very particular about how much he sleeps and what he eats and how he exercises and all this stuff. And so, you know, the other part of this is, like, for him on this personal journey is that he wants to know everything about himself, and the brain was like this last bit that he couldn't measure or understand.
Can we talk about his abs? And maybe your abs? How do your abs compare with his abs?
We are on YouTube. You can Ashley, right now.
When I started this story, I mean, so Brian and I are almost exactly the same age. We're both, the calendar says we're both 43, about to turn 44. And you know, we probably looked like somewhat similar 3 years ago when I first started talking to him. And I've gone, you know, one way, or I've stayed sort of the same. And this guy has gotten totally ripped. I mean, he eats one meal a day at very early in the morning. He eats like 2,300 calories in this one go and picks out all the food, and he does his workout in the morning. And, you know, to the extent you believe in all this stuff, he there's different ways you can kind of measure your biological age. And, you know, so he's gone from 43 to, the doctors say, he's got like the body basically of like a 25-year-old now.
Yeah. Okay.
I could go for that.
Forget the helmet. I want that, right?
So how does he has snorted stem cells. Does that help?
You know, it. So I did. I've seen him snort stem cells before. I mean, he goes to this wellness clinic in Colorado, this Grossman Wellness Center, and they like take out some of your blood and they spin it in a centrifuge and get the plasma, and then some kind of magic happens to the plasma that turns it into these stem cells. And the doctor, I saw him do it. He snorted them right up his nose. It's supposed to improve your memory, your kind of attitude, your general disposition and towards life. And he said it worked. He did it quite a few times, although he's stopped doing it now.
The details about him and who he is and his background is pretty incredible. Ashley, just got about 25 seconds left here. I mean, a bunch of investors, over 200, passed on investing in him. What's the hope for this? Like, what does this become? Because he's sending it out to, what, Harvard, the University of Texas, and other places. Just quickly, 20 seconds here. What could this become?
Yeah, you know, it's going to start out at research centers where people are going to be able to run tons more scans on brains, and then he wants it to become a consumer device, sort of like a Oura Ring or a Fitbit. That's the goal.
What do you think, Joel?
I mean, I'm going to try and wear it, and I don't know what's going to happen, but like the journey will be, you know, interesting. Whether or not I snort stem cells, I don't know.
Coming to maybe Bloomberg soon, these helmets. Ashley Vance, great stuff. Joel, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.